a single vortex in the system. Today we'll think about many vortices. How do you write a field phi that describes many vortices? Well, it's a functional of lots of positions. It's essentially going to be some density profile, square root, exponent. And now many vortices simply add their phases. So the phase is going to be a sum of all I, the vorticity of each vortex, and the angle coming from that vortex. In other words, phi I is just the angle phi of the vector x minus xi, where big xi is the position of the vortex. So this is an angle variable, and this is a field that describes many vortices. Now, it's true that I should put in here a profile density. The profile density would look like, and this is x1, this is x2. It should have some vanishing at the cores. But now I'm interested in the long-range interaction between them. So I could, in a sense, write the energy in a simplified form. So I can write the energy as an integral ddx, half m rho of x. And then I have here sum of I vi, all this squared. That's really the velocity at the position x. The total velocity is the sum of all the local velocities. Why? Because the local velocity vi is simply h bar grad phi minus q over h bar ca. So this is the contribution to the local velocity from a vortex I, and I'm summing up all these contributions because the phases add. When I write down the phase here, I just have to sum, because the phases add in the exponent, I have to sum over all the velocities. So I'm adding all the velocities of the different vortices, and I get this expression for the kinetic energy. And all the rest I'm not interested in, because that's essentially just the density. And I want to do an even more simplification. I want essentially to ignore the cores and think about the interactions only through the phase degrees of freedom. Yeah. Phi is a functional. This is a list of positions. Okay, so if I want to draw the phases, well, I'll have to draw the phases from each vortex and add them up. The phases are additive, and the velocities are additive. Velocities are additive exactly like they are in hydrodynamics. If I sit in a certain position next to vortices, the velocity of a particle at that position is going to be the velocity coming from vortex 1 plus the velocity coming from vortex 2 as vectors, and you sum them up. So that's the kinetic energy integrated over all space. And it's quite easy now to get the long-range behavior of this, because I'll just write this as sum over I ddx half m vi squared rho of x. This guy I call the core of vortex I. It's essentially the creation of a vortex if it were by itself. And the cross terms are interactions, plus E interaction, that depend on the positions. So the interactions, how do they depend on the position? They're essentially sum over I different than j, integral ddx, V of I dot V of J times rho 0. I'm now taking the distance between them to be large, so I'm replacing rho by rho 0. This is rho 0, which is the asymptotic density. And I need, of course, M and a half. So this is the interaction energy. The product of the velocities summed over all all the different vortices. So how do we evaluate such a sum? Evaluate this such a sum by making analogies to problems that we know. And the analogy, the first analogy one can make is to if you have in three dimensions, I have vortices essentially form lines and loops. So I can think of this is a vortex loop. It has currents going this way. Here's another vortex line. It has currents going this way. So it looks like a very complicated problem to find what is the dot product of the velocity coming from this vortex, every point in space, and integrate. But we notice the following relations about velocities. We know that in the static situation, div j, the total current, is equal to zero. That's true separately because j is simply rho zero times the velocity at every point. And since the velocity is additive, j is additive. And div j for every vortex is zero. So div j is equal to zero applies. And actually I can also write this as div v, right? Rho zero doesn't change in space. Div v is equal to zero every point. And another thing I could write is the line integral dl dot v, the line integral around the vortex is simply h bar divided by m integral grad phi, but that is nothing but k times 2 pi, ki times 2 pi. For every vortex, if I circulate the current around it, by definition, I'm going to get an integer times 2 pi. So this is equal to h times k divided by m. Okay, so I know this condition on the velocity I. I know also this condition for every single I, and of course on the sum because it's additive. Yes, question. Yeah? I'm just expanding sum over VI as sum over VI. I explained that VI, which is related to grad phi, is additive because if you look at the wave function, all the phases added. Okay, the expression for the kinetic energy, which I already derived, is the local velocity squared. The local velocity is the sum of all the contributions from the different vortices. Yeah, if I look at this point here, some position x, and ask what is the total velocity here? It's the total velocity coming from this vortex. So it's v, this call is vortex 1, this is vortex 2. So it's v1 as a vector plus v2 as a vector. That's my total velocity at the position x. Okay? And phases also add in the expression. Okay? So that's why it's additive. And it makes life very easy because this condition and this condition are very familiar from Maxwell's equations on magnetic fields. Remember, in Maxwell's equation, we know that div B is equal to zero and that cross B is equal to 4 pi over Cj. So if I take a line integral of B around a current carrying line, I will get the current in that line. So the analogy is very simple. Every single vortex line is like a current whose magnitude is given by k. If I write cross grad phi, right, this is equal to 2 pi times k. This is now a certain vortex k, a two-dimensional delta function of x perp minus x, which is taking a essentially a two-dimensional delta function because I'm thinking about the circulation in a plane perpendicular to the line. And this is exactly like saying that if I relate grad phi, which is related to V, I relate it to some kind of fictitious magnetic field, then the velocity, which is the analogy is between our velocity and the local magnetic field, tells us that what we really have to calculate is the magnetic interaction between lines of currents according to Biot-Savart law. That still is not simple, integrating Biot-Savart's law and finding magnetic field, and then magnetic field times and finding the forces and finding the eventual energy. But as you know, magnetostatics, all the kind of tricks of solving it, it's completely analogous to the question of interaction between complicated vortices. But I want to simplify life. I don't want to do three-dimensional vortices. That's a subject which is interesting by itself, but I want to simplify it because if the vortices are straight lines, life becomes much simpler. The vortices are, if you think about a situation where vortices are just straight lines in three dimensions, or this is my box and vortices look like this, then I can reduce the problem to two dimensions where I could use electrostatics, which is simpler than magnetostatics. And the idea is very simple. I look at the three-dimensional sample in terms of points on the surface of the three-dimensional sample. And I know by symmetry, since all the vortices are straight, that my currents are going to be, let's say, clockwise around vortices, anti-clockwise around anti-vortices, and I have to sum up such currents. But these circulating lines, I want to replace them with electric fields. I will define essentially 2D electrostatics. How do I go from magnetostatics to electrostatics in two-dimensional? Quite simple. I define, instead of a magnetic field, I'll define a fictitious electric field, which is simply given by z hat cross ji. This is now a field coming from vortex I. And what can I say? Well, first of all, I'll write it in terms of h bar rho 0 divided by m z cross grad phi I. So this is a fictitious electric field. But before I call it an electric field, I have to prove that it's a that its rotor is curl is zero, and I have to prove Poisson's law, that if I take its divergence, I get something analogy to charge. The charges will be actually the vorticities, and the fact that the rotor is zero is simply related to the fact that the divergence of the current is zero. So we do a very simple analogy. We take rot E, it's rot Z cross J, but rot Z cross J in two dimensions is simply div J in the Z direction. So it's 2D divergence of J. So this is zero because the current is conserved. The other equation, div E, is going to be div of Z cross J. Div of Z cross J becomes rotor of J, which is given by using this equation, 2 pi k, so I get, I translate j, so I have, this is rho 0 divided by m h bar, okay, so it's h bar, and then I have a rot grad phi, which is a quantity I calculated before. This was 2 pi times ki. So what I get here is h rho 0 divided by m times ki. And this is equal to 4 pi fictitious two-dimensional charge lambda I. So what I'm doing here is I'm identifying an electric charge with each vortex according to Poisson's law. And that electric charge is going to be given by ki rho 0 h bar divided by 2m. So it's just a electric charge, 2D electric charge. It has dimensions of charge density times length. So it's a line charge, 2D electric line charge. And okay, and now I have electrostatics. My problem of solving the energy of many vortices amounts to solving the energy of plus charges, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3, and 4. What I did is essentially replace the circulating currents with radially pointing electric fields. You want, this is my velocity v, and this is my electric field E. They're perpendicular because I multiplied by Z. And now I have an electrostatics problem. I have this kind of a picture. If the charges are the same, if the charges are opposite, I have dipoles. And I can have these field lines going, I don't know, maybe like this. Depending on the sign of the charges, I have some kind of electric field configuration. And it's quite simple to tell you what the energy is, because we know what the Coulomb law is in two dimensions. The electric field of charge I is simply 2 lambda I, Ri divided by Ri vector. Right? Goes like 1 over R, pointing radial. And we also know what the energy is for interacting of two line charges. In two dimensions, the energy is of interaction between x1 and x2, these are the positions of two vortices, is simply going to be, there's an overall unit of m divided by r0. I'm calculating the energy per length in the z direction. And I'm just going to get a Coulomb law, minus lambda I, lambda j, log, and there's a factor of 2 here, log of absolute value of xi minus xj, plus constant, because the potential is defined up to a constant. So you see the vortices interact logarithmically, quite long range. If they have the same sign, then this minus log is a function that is repulsive, wants to push the vortices away from each other, and quite strongly so. And that's the interaction energy between vortices, simply like line charges, okay? Now the question is, if they interact so repulsively and they want to throw each other away, why would the system have vortices at all? Well, notice here that I'm using the velocity just grad phi and I didn't put a gauge field. So in order to really get the full picture, I need to add the electromagnetic field, either a magnetic field or I can add a rotation. So I just have to modify the calculation by adding B, a real magnetic field B, or rotation And we said rotation is like replacing B by 2m omega in the z direction. I'm putting it perpendicular to the plane. What does that do to the interaction energy? Well, all the VIs now become h bar of m grad phi I minus m omega cross ri divided by h bar. That's the modification of the velocity due to the rotation. This is the essentially the, if you look at it, it's taking the velocity and moving and changing it to the moving velocity of the rotating frame. And when you write that, you get extra terms that go like omega in the interaction energy. And if you want to write it in terms of a magnetic field, this will be a half B cross RI. So that's in rotation, and that's field. Okay, two problems are exactly the same in the sense of when I add to the Hamiltonian B or a rotation, I get the modification of the velocities. And by expanding the expression written above the velocity there, and in my notes I do it to full glory, I'll get the full interaction energy, which depends on the positions of n vortices and depends on, let's say, the magnetic field. And how does it look like? It has the m over rho zero coefficient. It has the minus sum over I different than j, lambda I, lambda j, log xi minus xj interaction, repulsive interactions. And there's an extra term that comes from the magnetic field that looks like pi times sum over I, lambda I, times 2m omega xi squared. Or if I had a magnetic field, this will be a B, magnetic field, divided by a flux quantum, unit of flux quantum. Okay, what have I got here? I have essentially an interaction between charges. That's this guy. So let me draw the charges. Here are the charges, lambda 1, lambda 2, lambda 3. They repel each other if they all, let's say, are positive. So let's say all the lambda I's are equal to just 1 for a simple case. So I have charges, let's say, of the same sign, they repel each other. But here I have a term that is confining. So what I have here is a quadratic. This goes like xi squared. It's like a potential for all these charges that wants to shove them back into the center, right? It wants to minimize all the xi's. So as you can see, all these guys want to throw each other away, but they're sitting in a two-dimensional parabolic well, and they can't be thrown away. So there's a balance between this term and this term. Okay? This problem is called a 2D, one component, Coulomb plasma with neutralizing background charge. Why do I say that? Because x squared is a potential which can be thought of as coming from a uniform two-dimensional charge density. You can convince yourself that x squared is the solution of the problem Laplacian of a x squared is simply 4, and then the div will give me another 2, 2 times 2 will give me 4a. So it's a constant. And this is equal to 4 pi times some background charge density. So this A is a background charge density that will give us such a potential. So now what do we have? We have essentially a problem of logarithmically repelling charges, but an opposite uniform smeared charge density. Think about it as a plane. I'm putting inside the plane some raw background, minus, 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 minus. And then I'm plotting plus charges here that repel each other logarithmically, but they are essentially neutralized by the background. So overall, the system has a total charge, which is the sum of the charge of the background and the sum of the charge of the Coulomb plasma. So what do we know about Coulomb plasmas and neutralizing background charge? Well, from electrostatics, you know that if the number of charges here is different than the total charge that you put in the background, it'll cost you infinite energy to have the system, because the potential that will come out from this go all over space, and you'll have to integrate essentially the electrodynamics, the electrostatics, and you'll get that it'll cost you infinite energy not to balance exactly the number of charges with a neutralizing background. The system is also, because of these long-range logarithmic interactions, is incompressible. It's very, very stiff. If you try to move it, it costs you a finite energy, even at long wavelengths. Actually, like a 1 over r in 3 dimensions is also incompressible. But in 2 dimensions, a logarithmic interaction is very, very stiff. And as I said, completely has to be neutral. What does neutrality mean in this problem? It means that there's a relation between B divided by phi 0 and the density of charges n vortices. Density of vortices is called n vortices. So without doing any calculations, I know that the density of vortices has to be equal to the magnetic field divided by phi naught. What is the magnetic field divided by phi naught? It's the number of flux quanta I put in the system with an electric, with a magnetic field. Or if I put a rotation, there's a relation between m and omega. 2m omega has to be related to the density of vortices. So by imposing a rotation omega, I already know how many vortices are going into the system. A rotation will give us 2m omega divided by a flux quantum. That's essentially going to be the number of vortices. Or if I have a magnetic field, I'll count how many flux quanta in the system. That's the number of vortices. Very simple. Yes? Sorry, plasma? Plasma is a charged gas. And this is definitely charged. It has very strong long-range interactions. Okay, so that's the vortex physics. It's essentially described by classical plasma. And I'm doing everything statically here. I'm just looking at the variational minimum of the energy in the presence now of a field. And I find that the system wants to have vortices, and I don't know exactly how many vortices it's going to have. Question is, what will happen to those vortices once you put them in this system? Well, it's very simple. They want to minimize this repulsive interaction. They can't run away because of the confining potential. And the solution is going to be an Abrikosov lattice. This is why Abrikosov got the Nobel Prize. He identified that vortices want to sit in 2 dimensions, and actually, they really want to sit even in 3 dimensions because they want to be straight. It costs them energy to bend. They want to sit in a triangular lattice. And you know the lattice constant because you know the density of vortices, because it's equal to the density of flux quanta. So this is going to be the solution in a field B. And superconductors have this situation when you put a magnetic field on them. And rotating atoms in traps, in cold atoms in traps, also have shown a triangular lattice of vortices that depend on the rotation frequency. Helium 4, when you put it into a cylinder and you rotate the cylinder with frequency omega, will form an Abrikosov lattice. Okay, this is a neutral helium 4. And one would want to know, for instance, how would you see such vortices? So every system, you have different tricks. With helium 4, you could use optics, because there is a bit of change of the refraction index of optics when you have a low density and a high density, and the vortex cores have low density, so these things appear in images. But in fact, in helium 4, it was detected in a more interesting way, which is the same way it was detected in neutron stars, by the way. It was you start rotating, and this argument that the number of vortices is equal to the rotation is really up to an integer, right? If I'm rotating smoothly and I'm increasing the rate of rotation, then every time I have an integer number of flux quanta in the rotation, I'll get another vortex, but it'll be constantly jumps. Jumps in what? Essentially jumps in the moments of inertia. Because once you add another vortex, the moment of inertia is changed. So people have seen in rotation experiment, when they measure moments of inertia, they've seen jumped as a function of frequency omega. And that's essentially the number of vortices. And that was an indication that indeed there is a vortex lattice here. And then you can image it directly and see it. In cold atoms, I don't have a projector. I could show you some pictures, but you can find them on the net. There's very beautiful just images of rotating cold atoms that look like, so they're in a kind of a circular trap, but they look like they have, you know, up to 60 vortices locked in there when it's rotated. If you think about this, these vortex lattice, it's actually not a trivial thing to explain. Because what happened is, when you start rotating in a superfluid, it doesn't care about the rotation. It's a superfluid. It wants to maintain its zero current, lowest energy. But in the rotating frame, it starts seeing this Coriolis action coming in. And the Coriolis action, in the combination with quantum mechanics, tells it that the ground state, being uniform phase, is no longer a good energy. Only when the Coriolis action becomes strong enough, it pays to induce vorticity. So these vortices should be understood in the rotating frame, exactly like you understand putting a magnetic field on charged particles makes them move in cycloton orbits. And that cycloton orbit, of course, has a different wave function and a different circulation than when the particles are in the K equals zero condensate. So these are all ways of imaging it. But the nicest way of imaging it in cold atoms is actually through direct imaging of the phase phi. So how do you see a vortex by looking at the phase? Well, this requires taking two condensates and interfering them. What happens with two condensates? Well, we have all the tools to explain it very easily. Two condensates, I have phi 1 describing one, and I have phi 2 describing another one. And when two condensates come together, my wave function phi becomes simply phi 1 plus phi 2. It's a superposition of the field in the wave function. Yes? Okay, so now I'm talking about two liquids or Bose gases of the same type, of the same atom, prepared in different places in space, and now I'm making them collide. So the picture is, I have atoms here, and I have atoms here. They're identical. And this is phi 1, that describes this condensate. This is phi 2, describes this condensate. And I'm bringing them together. What will happen? These are indistinguishable particles. They will sit in one coherent state. It's not a superposition of coherent states. They'll sit in one coherent state. But the field that describes that coherent state is just going to be the superposition of the two fields. And from these, you get interference effect experiments. For it, because if phi 1 and phi 2 are slightly different, then you get interference. For instance, if I take phi 1 is rho e to the I k 1 x, let's say that phi 1 is describing particles with a certain momenta, wave vector k1. And then I have phi 2 is, let's say, the same density, but k2x. What is the superposition? The superposition is rho e to the I k1 plus k2x times, divided by 2, times cosine of k1. I can add here some arbitrary phase if I want, phi 1. K1 minus K2 divided by 2 times x plus phi 1. So the condensate will have a new phase, but it will also have an amplitude modulation of the density. So when you take two condensates with different momenta, you get essentially a density fluctuation with a period K1 minus K2 over 2. So the density will have nodes. If it's precisely equal amplitudes, it'll have nodes. Otherwise, it'll be just modulations. And there'll be some interference pattern, which depends on k1 minus 2 pi divided by k1 minus k2 over 2. That's an interference pattern. So taking two condensates and then taking a picture of the density, you will see, for instance, in this case, you will see lines of high and low densities. Okay? That shows you there's a relative momentum difference between them. If the two condensates were identical, you won't see anything because when you measure with optics, you don't measure the phase, you measure the density. Okay, now the question is, what happens if I take phi 1, which is a plane wave, but phi 2, which has a vortex? How would it look like? So if I take phi 1 is rho 0 e to the I, k, let me take k times y. So it has a, it's a plane wave in the y direction. And phi 2, sorry, that's not a Dirac yet, it's a field. And phi 2 is square root of rho 0 e to the I phi angle of the position x. And I interfere them. What will happen? Well, you'll get phi total is square root of rho 0, e to the I k y plus phi of x divided by 2. That's just an overall phase, uninteresting. And then I'll get the interference, which is essentially the difference between this and that. So it's cosine of k y minus phi of x divided by 2. So again, I get modulation. How does this modulation look like? It's a funny function. If I take phi equal to 0 and I go very far away, it depends only on y. So if this is the vortex position, x equals 0, that's the vortex position. If I go here, I'll get lines of interference this way, right? That's the ky. This is 2 pi divided by ky. Divided by 2. It's this distance. Okay. What happens if I go here? Well, again, I'll get distances which will be of order 2 pi divided by k, but it will be offset. And if you look how it's going to be offset, it's going to look like this. Now I have to join them. And joins like this. So when you look at the interference pattern of two condensates, one with a vortex and one without, you see a defect in the interference. Now, I keep coming back to solids all the time. This is exactly how a defect in a solid looks like when you have a dislocation and it has topological properties. You can measure it by looking at displacements very far away, exactly like you can measure vorticity by looking at the velocities very far away. But this is an image that was seen in cold atoms when they interfered states with vortices and states without. And it really it shows up very nicely as a place where some nodes end or antinodes end. And if you had a vortex and an antivortex, then it will end. For instance, if this is an antivortex, it will patch itself up. And you can immediately see the stress between a vortex and an antivortex. The last thing I want to say is what happens in a superconductor. Yes? A straight line. Okay, I told you that all this analysis is for straight line vortices, but now I tell you that straight line vortices are the lowest energy. I didn't prove it, but for magnetostatics, you can imagine that wires which are straight have lower energy than bent wires. There's a curvature energy to the bending of the wires, and that's why if you relax a system with vortices, they will straighten up. Okay? Again, I'm not proving him, I'm just using analogies from elasticity. Yeah? Okay, I gave you the mechanism of creation by rotation or magnetic field. It just reduces the energy to create vortices. In fact, we know exactly how many. One vortex per flux quantum.
Or what? Dynamically.
Dynamically. That's a very difficult question to answer. If you start with a state that's uniform, usually vortices will creep in. You know, experimentally what you do is you get them from the edge, because at the edge to create a vortex doesn't cost you any energy because there's no condensate there. So that's where the vortices come from. They come from the edges inwards. And when you change the magnetic field, they escape out. This motion of vortices in and out is exactly what creates electric fields and stuff, and we'll talk about that soon. But the last thing I wanted to do, because I really think that the mathematics of all this business is nice and cute, but the most important part is that this is a huge subject of experimental and interesting phenomena. So the Abrikosov lattice in superconductors carry an extra Higgs mechanism. We know that when you put a vortex in a superconductor, the currents that go around create a magnetic field themselves. If it's a three-dimensional system, not a two-dimensional, those currents are sufficiently large to cancel the magnetic field that comes in and screen. In fact, we know from flux quantization that if the velocities are to go to zero far from the vortex, you would know exactly how much magnetic field there is in every one of them. So the vortex lattice in the superconductor is flux tubes. And I'm emphasizing these are 3D superconductors. And what happens is each vortex is a small solenoid, and that solenoid creates essentially a magnetic field whose total flux is precisely phi Josephson, which is hc over 2e. Okay? And that's where the magnetic field goes. The magnetic field actually penetrates the sample from one side to the other through these flux tubes, but it doesn't penetrate anywhere else. Here, b is equal to 0 and j is equal to 0. And the interaction between vortices is no longer power logarithmic like we did in the neutral case, but it's exponentially small once we go beyond the lambda penetration depth, lambda, which we calculated before. So each vortex has a size lambda, weakly interacting. They still form a triangular lattice, but you now can image them not by looking at velocities, but looking at the magnetic fields that come out. And there are several ways of imaging. One is SQUID, which is a very sensitive magnetometry. then you can actually measure the magnetic field as a function of position. The second way is atomic force microscopy. And the third way is Bitter decoration. That's the simplest way, and that was the first way that was used. Bitter decoration is just throw some ferromagnetic material, some shavings of iron, on top of a superconductor and look at it. And you'll see the vortex lattice. It'll just be where magnetic dust accumulate. And that was the first proof that the Bykossov lattice really exists, and indeed all this theory is correct. But these imaging techniques have been developed much, much further, and the one who actually does those experiments to highest precision is Cam Moller in Stanford. And it's just another way of imaging the small-scale superconductivity. Yeah. Josephson flux is just HC over 2E instead of E. The flux quantum in Byers-Young theory was HC over E. The flux quantum in superconductors HC over 2E. The 2E comes from the particle is a boson, and the boson has charge 2E. While there's statements you can make on fermionic single electron systems where the flux quantum is HC over E. So that's why this is called Josephson, and the other one is called just flux quantum, and just words that people use, okay? Not okay, so this is essentially telling us everything about statics that we want to know, and now we'll do dynamics. Because, of course, dynamics is more interesting than statics. What is dynamics? Dynamics is asking not just what is the ground state or what is the variational configuration, a coherent state that minimizes the energy, but asking about what will happen as a function of time to a wave packet that you prepare, or what would the system do in response to a field, and how would you get things moving around? For instance, a vortex, can it move? And if it moves, how does it move? And if we know how vortices move, how can we measure it? All these questions would be answered only if we have a dynamical equation. But fortunately, we have a dynamical equation because we have a path integral. And I go back now to the field path integral in its full glory and show how you get an equation of motion. So what did we have? We had this expression that I derived for the boson gas. And I'm going to use that one. And then I'm going to talk about how general that expression is to systems like superconductors that are not derived from a boson gas. So for Bose gas, or Bose liquid, or let's call it Bose gas, my Green's function was a path integral over the phi, which is now a function of x and t, exponent I integral d dx, integral d dt, of phi star phi dot. Okay, there's a I'm putting here an overall I. I already am discussing dynamics. So I'm looking at the Green's function. So it has an I in front. This guy didn't have an I in front, so I'm placing an I here. And then there's the Hamiltonian, which depends on phi star phi. And I'm integrating all this guy d dx d dt. This is over the whole volume. This is from 0 to some time t. This is the action. Yes. Yes, but in the spin problem, I also discussed dynamics by not discussing z, but discussing g, which is analytical continuum t to it. And all that changes is you get an I in front here, okay? And That's it, essentially. And now you have, essentially, a path integral, which is S I S of phi, exactly like you have in the Feynman path integral, except that our degrees of freedom are these complex fields phi. Okay, how do we get dynamics semi-classically? Semi-classically, and I'm saying, again, this is an approximation, which is called a saddle point approximation, which is not a precise evaluation of G, but an approximate one. That will give us an equation where we have to variationally minimize this S as a function of delta phi. So it's giving me something like classical equation of motion, ds d phi equal to 0, and also ds d phi star equal to 0. These two equations are exactly analogous to taking the S to the real part of phi and the S to the imaginary part of phi and setting it equal to 0. It's two different ways of doing the same thing. But this is easier because it's easier to read from this what the equations are. Okay, so let us do it. ds d phi star equal to 0 is simply, here I'm just going to get I phi dot minus, and here I have to take the functional derivative of the energy functional with respect to phi star and set to 0. So let us remind ourselves what is the energy functional. It's d dx of phi star minus I h bar grad minus q over h bar c. Okay, I'll do it this way. A phi, this is a square here. There's a minus h bar over 2m. And then there's a minus mu phi star phi plus g over 2 phi to the fourth. If I want to take a derivative of E with respect to phi star, I'll get this term, I'll get this term, and this term. So I'll get I phi dot is equal to minus h squared over 2m grad minus q over h bar c a. I've forgotten I here. I squared times phi. That's going to be this term. And here I'll get minus mu times phi. And here I'll get plus, and when I take the derivative with respect to phi star, it appears this is phi star, phi star, phi, phi. So when I take the derivative with respect to phi star, I get a factor of 2. So I get plus g times phi squared with an extra phi. That's an equation of motion for phi as a function of time. It looks deceivingly similar to the Schrödinger equation for single particle states, except for this term. Because the Schrödinger equation is I psi dot is equal to the Schrödinger operator. I can also add to the action and to the Hamiltonian some confining potential if I want, which would be some Vx times phi, and it will even look closer to the Schrödinger equation. But it's not. It's the Gross-Pitayevsky equation. A very celebrated equation. There's lots of people who solve it in many different configurations, adding, as I said, potentials. So let me add here, plus V of X times phi. I can add that. Solving it in different configurations, different boundary conditions, starting numerics, essentially, and doing a lot of things which are very relevant to dynamics of both gases. This equation can be shown to conserve current and give us, when you take its derivatives, it can give us conservation of current. Rho dot plus div j is equal to 0. That could be shown as an exercise. And it has other important properties. The most important property I want to discuss now is that this equation conserves energy. Okay, it has energy conservation. That's very simple to prove. How do you show it? You just take a time derivative of the energy. Okay, so I want to, first of all, define the solution of the Gross-Peterewski equation is called phi classical of x and t. It's a particular field, okay? It means that there is some coherent state, which is psi classical of x and t, that describes the approximately the many-body wave function of as a function of t. Now, it's not equal to the many-body wave function. The many-body wave function evolves under the Heisenberg operator, under the time evolution of the Schrödinger operator, and does not look like a coherent state. Looks like a superposition of many coherent states. So assuming that the evolution keeps you constantly in a coherent state is wrong for the actual evolution, but it's an approximation. It's an approximation which, when it holds, it means that the Gross-Peterewski equation is useful. But before I discuss, I don't want to discuss too much deviations from this Gross-Peterewski equation, but I'm saying that this property of this field is to conserve energy in the sense that the expectation value of the Hamiltonian in phi classical, call it E of phi classical, is constant. Why is that true? Because dE dt is an integral d dx of the functional derivative of dE to d phi star dot, plus the functional derivative of dE to d phi dot. But phi dot, I times phi dot, is dE d phi star. So this guy is minus I dE delta E delta phi star. That's how we derived the Gross-Peterewski equation. This guy is the complex conjugate of this. So it's plus I dE d phi. So now we have two objects with a relative minus sign. This is zero. So energy does not change. So the Gross-Peterewski equation tells you about some field that is moving, like a classical field, conserving the expectation value of the Hamiltonian, the energy, and essentially non-dissipative. This is called non-dissipative because a motion that changes the energy is dissipative. So it's quite limited, actually, because we expect when things move, also energy to dissipate. And this equation can't give us that. But it can give us some approximate solutions for problems like what would a vortex do if you put it into a superfluid in some initial conditions? What are the equations of motion for a vortex? So how do I do that? I have to take this equation of motion and write phi as a field of a vortex. Yes? I set h bar equal to 1 in the Berry phase. Okay, so if I want to put it back, I need to put it back in the Berry phase. So I didn't do that, but okay, yeah. Yeah, that's where the h bar comes in. I'm sorry that I'm sometimes putting h bar and sometimes not. So ignore this h bar here. Set it to 1. I'm working with h bar equal to 1. But when you do the analytic continuation from imaginary time to real time, then your action goes to e to the I over h bar s. And in real time, you have different dimensions of time. It's dimensions of energy instead of time. So that's where the h bar is missing. Anyway, so I'm now, I want to discuss motion of vortices. or motion of a single vortex, and then we, how do I do that? Well, I can write phi of x and t as square root of rho zero, just to make things life simple, e to the phi, the angle now, of x minus a position that depends on time. So what am I talking about here? I'm talking about a vortex which his profile doesn't change, stays the same. I could put it a constant or make it have a core, doesn't matter. What changes is the position where I'm measuring the angle from. So if you want a moving vortex at t equals 0 is here, and then it's here. This is the phase, constant phase at t equals 1. That's a motion of a vortex, just moving the point. I'm thinking of it as a point particle in two dimensions. Okay, let me make it two dimensions. Actually, motion of vortices is completely not very, okay, I wouldn't say it's irrelevant, but it's difficult to observe in three dimensions because you have lines, and lines get stuck very easily. So motion of vortices and their effects on dissipation is mostly a two-dimensional phenomena when you have very thin layers, and then this description is useful. So if the dependence on time is totally through x of t, then phi dot is simply grad phi times x. Right, I'm taking derivative with respect to x, so it's actually minus grad phi dot xi dot. That's just chain rule. Okay, now if I take rho of 0 to be a constant, this will be minus rho of 0 square root times grad of phi, this phi, dot with xi dot. That's the time dependent of the field. Okay, this is a function of position everywhere, as like this is a function of position and time. So I have here essentially an expression that tells me what is phi dot. And I can write the equation of motion, the Gross-Pitevsky equation of motion, using this as there's an I here, so it's I times minus I, so I get rho 0 x dot dot with grad phi I of x is equal to, now I have essentially dE d phi, which depends on the position xi. So what I need to do is solve this equation of motion, which is now at every point in x. And that equation, when I write it essentially as an equation of motion for the position x, will give me what is the dynamics of the vortex. How does the vortex move? What is this x dot? That's what I'm looking for. This is the vortex motion. So I need to know how to solve it, and it's quite simple. So I'll show you how this guy is solved. Okay. Actually, I forgot here e to the I phi. So what I want to do is actually I'll write this as phi of x. So I'll write the Gross-Pitevsky equation. And okay, so my Gross-Pitevsky equation is the following. The energy for a vortex divided by the length in the z direction is equal to integral dx, 1 over L. Now I have here phi star, and I have here essentially this Gross-Pitevsky operator times phi. See how it works here. No, I'll do it the following way. So I got the equation phi dot for the vortex, and that's equal to the Gross-Pitevsky operator times phi. That was this Schrödinger equation, which depends on x as a function of x and t. This is also a function of x and t. This was equal to phi of x and t times, as we wrote there, this grad phi I of x times xi dot. Yes, that's what I have here. So that was the time derivative. This was the Gross-Pitevsky operator times phi of x, x of t. This equation is true for every x and t. What I'll do now is I'll multiply this equation by phi star of x and t and integrate it over dx. What will that do? Well, if I multiply, well, I should put the integral sign on the other side. I'll multiply the equation and integrate d dx. Why would I want to do that? Because if I multiply by pi psi star, I'll get here essentially an expression which is psi star psi, which is rho 0. So I'll get rho 0. And then I'll get this integral, which we did before, grad phi dot, and it's dotted with, and it's d dx. Actually, I'll make it two-dimensional, so it's d2dx, and there's a factor of L in front. So I'll get this grad phi d2dx, all this dotted with xi dot, and that's equal to essentially the Gross-Pitevsky energy E of phi star of x and phi of x. So I got this expression that has essentially, on the right-hand side, a functional of the position x. That's all. And on the left-hand side, I got this expression. So now I can evaluate this. This is an integral we did before. You remember, this is the integral that gave us the momentum, dotted x dot. So this guy on the left is just equal to h k rho 0 x position of the vortex cross z dotted with x dot. And that's equal to the energy as a function of x. So now we have an equation of motion for x, and we don't have any fields anymore. So if we know to evaluate the energy of a vortex at position x, this is the equation of motion. How do you solve it? Well, one way to solve it is simply to take a gradient of both sides with respect to x. So take gradient with respect to x of E. That's like a force. That will be equal to taking a gradient with respect to x of this time. Now, this side is easy to take a gradient because I can move the cross here, and I could put this as a dot product. And then taking the gradient is simply going to give me z cross x dot. So that's going to give me h k rho 0 z cross x dot. Let me write it in components. So d e with respect to d x of the vortex. So this is x and y of the vortex. So d of the x is going to give me the y dot. Did I forget a minus sign? I think I had a minus sign here. So this is going to be d dx is going to be minus y dot. Times h k rho 0. And dy is going to give plus x dot times h k rho 0. So we got very simple equations of motion for the vortex. What does the vortex velocity want to do? Well, it wants to go perpendicular to the force that acts on it. Okay? So if I have some energy dependence, which is telling me what force is going acting on the position x, the motion is not going to be in the direction of the force, but perpendicular. This will make sure that energy is conserved, because if I take dE to dt, it's going to be dE to the x dot, plus dE to the y dot. But this is just going to be proportional to dE dy, and this is going to be proportional to dE dx with a minus sign. Again, we get zero. So the motion of vortices is energy conserving. In fact, this already tells us what is the orbit that the vortex is going to take. It's going to walk on equal potential contours of E. It's what's called phase-space dynamics. You conserve energy, and you move along equipotential contours of E. So if E has some kind of a contour plot like that, E equal to constant, and this is the x and y axis, a vortex would just move like that. It won't leave the contour. It will conserve energy. It will move, but along a contour. Now, when do we get some such kind of energies like this? When you put potentials in the problem. If you didn't have a potential, then everything is translation invariant, then in principle, the vortex won't move at all. This will be zero. But if you have some potential, it could move. Another case it could move is if I have a current flowing through the system. Then we learned that the energy does depend on x. It gives us a force perpendicular to the current. So the question one asks, what happens if you pass a current and you have a vortex? Where will the vortex move? Last time I told you it wants to move perpendicular. That was the magnet force, right? The force that lifts airplanes. But this equation of motion is telling you, aha, there is a force here that wants to move perpendicular to the current. But the motion is going to be perpendicular to that force. So the overall result is the vortex is going to move in the absence of dissipation, it's going to move with the flow. And I can immediately tell you at what velocity. So let's remind ourselves of the Magnus force and solve the equation of motion in the presence of the Magnus force. Okay, so the Magnus force was F Magnus was minus grad E. That's the Magnus force in the presence of a velocity. It was H K rho 0 Z cross the velocity. That was what we got last time with a minus sign. So if I have a velocity Vs of a superflow and I have a vortex here, there is a force that wants to move it this way. That's the Magnus force. Now we have an equation of motion. That's dynamics. I want to separate statics from dynamics. By the way, in many books it's so confusing to separate the Magnus force from the Magnus dynamics. The Magnus dynamics, non-dissipative, is very special to the approximations of the Gross-Peterewski in the absence of quantum corrections. And in that case, we use the equation of motion written there, and that gives us H times K times rho 0 times Z cross X dot. So that's equal to F Magnus. And the solution is very simple. It's exactly the same coefficients. X dot of the vortex is going to be equal to the velocity of the superfluid. So I have a velocity here. There's a force. The force doesn't move the vortex in this direction. It moves it in this direction, exactly in the same velocity as the superfluid. So I can summarize all this complicated calculation with go with the flow. Non-dissipative, and I could have guessed it from the beginning, because if I have a translation invariant system where the Gross-Peterewski should work, because there's no potentials, no scattering, momentum is conserved, all that, I can move to the moving frame and say, in a moving frame, I want to put a vortex in a moving frame. In a moving frame, there's no current, so the vortex will stay where it is, no forces on it. Okay, so now I move to the lab frame, and that solution should be just a moving vortex. So I didn't need to do all these calculations. The purpose of all this exercise is to show you that dynamics could be tricky. The force is there. The energy will really be minimized if the vortex could move this way. The reason it doesn't move that way comes from using the Gross-Peterewski saddle point approximation. That equation is wrong in a superconductor, in cases where you have impurities, in cases where you have bosons on a lattice rather than in the continuum. Remember, we started with lattice bosons, and then we went to the continuum limit at low density. Now, if you go back to higher concentration of bosons on the lattice, lattice effect will change the equations of motion, and they won't be true anymore. In superconductors, people never even use these equations of motion because the vortices there are so dissipative that they immediately move in the direction of the force. But what's different between a superconductor and the continuum Gross-Peterewski? In a superconductor, there's phonons, there's other electrons, there's impurities, and all these can absorb momentum and scatter, and the translation invariance that is necessary for these equations to hold don't hold. So then you have to discuss dissipative motion. Why is the direction of the motion of the vortex so important? Well, that actually is the transport property of the system. This will give you voltage. And wherever the vortex moves, voltage will be created. So it's important to know where it moves. I will show you, well, I don't have too much time for that, but very briefly I will show you that voltage is created perpendicular to the motion of the vortex. So if vortices move downstream with this velocity of the superfluid, there will be an EMF between one side and another, which is totally hydrodynamic, okay? It's true in a superfluid as in a superconductor. It has nothing to do with electromagnetism. It has to do with the fact that when vortices move, there is a stress built up in the system between one side of the motion and any other. And when they move downstream, you'll get essentially a Hall voltage, because you'll get a voltage perpendicular to the current. This is J. This is V. It'll be perpendicular because the motion of the vortex will be downstream. If the vortex instead went upstream, went perpendicular according to the Magnus force, it will create a longitudinal voltage. So Vx is proportional to Y dot, and V Hall is proportional to X dot. So by knowing which direction the vortex moves, we know how much Hall voltage it gives us and how much dissipative longitudinal voltage. I call the longitudinal voltage dissipative because when I have a current and a voltage in the same direction, I get power dissipated by Joule's law. When the current and the voltage are perpendicular, there's no energy lost in that system. So vortex motion is really crucial to understanding creation of voltages and the breakdown of superconductivity. In a superfluid, what is analogous to the voltage? It's a pressure drop. So a superfluid cannot support, if the vortices are stuck, cannot support any pressure drop. But once the vortices move, there's going to be difference in pressure. There's going to be a stress in the superfluid. So the superfluid can suddenly support stress. Okay? And that is essentially the reason a superconductor and a superfluid create a voltage drop or a pressure drop in a superfluid. It's totally hydrodynamic. It comes from the equations that we have here. And unlike, actually, a mistake in Tinkham's book that explains the electrodynamics of superconductors as moving flux tubes, that's not true. It's not that the magnetic field is moving and that creates an EMF. It's the stress in the matter field itself that creates the EMF. So that last point is something I'll explain briefly. It's in my notes. Anybody's interested in deepening his knowledge, read it there. I just want to explain why you can create an actual voltage or stress by moving a vortex. And that will be the last thing I'll explain. So, what is a stress field in a solid, in a liquid? Stress field at a position x is really simply the momentum change locally, V dot of the superfluid. So if V is constant, not changing, there's no stress. But if there's a local acceleration, you'll feel a stress field according to this description. Okay, so that is the, if you want, the local stress field. And when you write it in terms of a moving vortex, it'll be just h bar grad phi of a moving vortex dot. So if I draw a vortex here, and I'll just do it by pictures now, and this vortex is moving with a velocity x dot, big x dot, all these phases are now changing, right? So how are they changing? They're gradients, which are just the directions perpendicular to the phase, are changing direction. In which way will they change? Well, you can see that they will change in a direction that is actually, it looks essentially like a dipolar configuration, where this field here, stress, as a function of position, if this is the velocity v, it'll look like a dipole. Just if you plot this function when you move in the x direction. So the velocity is in the v direction. The dipole moment, d, is z cross v. And the stress field is the stress field of a dipole moment in two dimensions whose direction is perpendicular to the velocity. Now, a stress field that looks like a dipole means that every point here in the superfluid will feel a small force on it. The force will actually change as a function of position. But what I'm interested in, let's put a lot of vortices in the system. So if you put a lot of vortices in the system, all of them the same, and all of them moving the same velocity v, they will create dipoles which add up. It'll be exactly like the problem of electrostatics, where overall, I'll get a polarization. I'll get is equal to the stress field, the total. So what do I learn from this? That there will be a polarization, and the polarization will be proportional to the velocities of all the particles, let's say all the vortices move with the same velocity, times the density of the vortices. So notice I get something that looks like an electric field on particle, but there's no charge necessarily. This is neutral, superfluid. It's a stress. It says that these particles want to fly away this way, and this one wants to fly here, and all because vortices are moving. So this puts a field, and if I integrate the field, I get essentially a potential drop from one side over the other that is introduced by the motion of vortices in this way. So now you see that motion of vortices relates to an electric field. I can define an electric field as essentially the stress divided by Q in order to have the right dimensions. And this is an EMF. This is an electromotive force introduced by moving vortices. And it will simply be given by an expression that is very simple to write down, H Z cross density of vortices times their velocity. This is called the vorticity current. The vorticity current is the density of vortices. I can multiply by the vorticity in here to define the density of vorticity weighted by the vorticity of every vortex times the velocity. Very simple relation between an EMF and vortex moving, and it depends on the density of vortices. The more vortices move, the faster they move, the stronger the electric field I'm creating. This is very important in hydrodynamics, because if one wants to understand pressure drops in a fluid, it's closely related to motion of vorticity. You must have vortices, and they must be moving in a perpendicular direction to your current in order to create a pressure drop. Okay? No vortices, no pressure drop, no electric field. And now transport could be related to motion of vortices. If I have a system and I have a current flowing, bosonic current, JS, and I have vortices here, and those vortices will feel, because of the current, they'll feel a Magnus force. Perpendicular, right? Okay, I'm drawing the current this way. These are the Magnus directions. Okay, now these vortices don't want necessarily to move in the direction of the Magnus force because they have their own conductivity tensor. They might want to move in the direction of the force, or maybe perpendicular if there's no dissipation, or if there's a little bit of dissipation, they might move in an angle. So I will draw it with a color, but don't have any colors. It's too bad. So I'm stuck in this corner. Let me draw it in the big picture and then finish. So the vortex motion is driven by the current. The current introduces F magnus on every vortex. Now, the vortices might decide to move in some direction. V of the vortex. That angle that will be created by their motion would also tell me that they will introduce an EMF. The EMF is perpendicular to that. So this will produce an E field. If this is J field, that is actually perpendicular to the motion that is driven by the Magnus force. So then I'll get the conductivity tensor will be E is equal to a resistivity tensor times J. Resistivity tensor will have rho xx, rho xy, rho yx, rho yy, and this is anti-symmetric by Onsager relation. It's a 2x2 matrix that relates the direction of the current to the direction of the field. This is the resistivity of the system that will develop because of the motion of vortices. I could instead think about the vortex system as charges, seeing, if you want, an electric field, which is the Magnus force, and moving with a velocity that's their current. So there is a relation between the vortex vorticity current and that's these Vs and the forces that act on them, like a field that acts on them, which is the Magnus force. Let's call it again Magnus. And this is now a vorticity tensor coupling J to E of vortices. So this is vortex resistivity tensor. What is the connection between vortex resistivity tensor and particle resistivity tensor? They're just the inverse of one another. So if you want, the vortex is equal to the charge resistivity tensor to the minus one. This is a very important relation called vortex charge duality. It shows the close connection between vortices and charges. Charges will have a transport coefficient where I apply a voltage and I get a current that's a conductivity tensor, or I apply a current and I get a voltage that's a resistivity tensor. But the vortices, their motion, which is related now not to current but to induced EMF, and their forces are actually related to current. So the current voltage relation is completely inverted between the role it plays on charges and the role it plays on vortices. And this immediately tells us that phases of matter of charges are dual to phases of matter of vortices. For instance, a vortex solid or a vortex insulator is a case where all the vortices are stuck, they don't move. Their resistivity is infinite. That means the conductivity of charge is infinite, that's a superconductor. On the other hand, if vortices can move around very freely, then this resistivity becomes small, this resistivity of the charge becomes large, that means I'm getting into the insulator behavior. And there's been a lot of studies of transitions in systems, very important transitions between insulators and superconductors. And the picture on both sides of the transition is simply a it's simply a dual relation between vortices and charges. The subject of ongoing research, it's called superconductor insulated transitions in thin films and Josephson arrays. This is temperature. This is the resistivity of systems that at low temperature become really, really low, like a superconductor. Here, each curve is changing density, Josephson coupling, changing essentially superfluid stiffness, let's say. That's one parameter you can change. You can change magnetic field. And suddenly, when you cross a critical point, at low temperature, it becomes insulating. While at high temperature, it looks very similar. At low temperature, one guy is an insulator and one guy is a superconductor. This phase transition is very similar to the quantum phase transition I described for antiferromagnets when you go between an antiferromagnetic ordered state and a paramagnetic disordered state. It's the analogous using the same field theoretical ideas to one-dimensional higher XY model, which has a phase transition at finite temperature. Temperature translates, in this case, to stiffness. And this is a quantum phase transition or quantum critical point that you can approach by changing parameters, like in the magnetic problems I discussed before. But one idea of thinking about this guy and this guy is to use here bosons and here to use vortices. So the idea is that this insulator is actually a superfluid of vortices. If the vortices are in a superfluid state, their conductivity is infinite. That means that the resistivity is infinite for the bosons. And bosons and vortices have similar dynamics. And this duality gave some expectation that the resistivity exactly at this point will be a universal number that is close to what is measured. But still, there's some problems in the theory. I'm not saying everything is fixed. But I wanted just to mention vortex charge duality. You might hear about it in different contexts in physics, not just in superfluids. But I think I more or less covered the basic stuff. I hope you continue find interest in condensed matter beyond this course. And there's much more that you could learn from the notes and the book. And I'm sure I allowed Dennis to put more chapters of my book online for your use if you want. And you can send me emails with questions. And hope to see you again in your academic life. So thank you very much.